Okay, can you hear me?
I can.
Great. And you're on a landline, right? Oops.
I am.
There we go. I've got this. I used to live in Western Massachusetts, and then my mother, who passed away in June, became very ill.
Sorry.
Well, she was quite old, and she had a really great run. I mean, she was in her 90s, so.
Mm. Oh, wow.
But I moved here to take care of her and the east end of Long Island, and I'm having a hard time moving back. It's so nice here.
Oh, wow. Did you get affected by Sandy?
Yeah, I didn't personally, but there were people here whose homes were flooded and washed away and stuff. Then there was a woman who died not in Montauk, which is pretty close to here. We're the next community over. Yeah, I'm not actually in the storm surge area, which
That's
is nice. Yeah, I was very fortunate, but of course there were many people who were.
Yes.
Yeah, and in fact, we'll get to that. I'm going to ask you some question about that, because it was a lot of resonance.
There was, yes.
Well, Sarah Kilborn, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's wonderful to talk to you.
And I should say Sarah Skinner Kilborn, because you are actually a descendant of the subject of this story, William Skinner. This is the remarkable story of William Skinner, a man who turned disaster into destiny, in this book, American Phoenix. So did you grow up with some of these stories when you were a kid?
That's a great question. And a lot of people ask me that because they think, well, you've just written a book about your ancestor. You must have grown up hearing about him. And as you noted earlier, my middle name is Skinner, and I'm actually named after William Skinner's second wife. Her name was Sarah Skinner. And so I'm named after his second wife, and William Skinner was the founder of the family company. The silk business that he grew was passed down in the generations, and my grandfather was actually the last president of the company. And so you would think with all these connections, I would have grown up hearing about him, but I actually didn't. And, you know, people wonder, wow, what, why, you know? And I think it's simply because the family company was sold. And at that point, you know, Skinner had died so long before. He died in 1902. And his story became secondary to the growth of the company because it lasted until 1961, and it was such a huge company that, you know, I grew up hearing about the company as opposed to its founder, William Skinner. And yet the reason how I got to write the story about Skinner was still through a family member. And his second youngest daughter, Belle Skinner, was a very famous philanthropist in France after World War I. And what she did was legally adopt from the French government an entire village in the northeast of France, and she rebuilt it after the war. And it was a binding legal document, this adoption, and she took on this village that the government was going to abandon because they considered it hopeless. It had been so horrifically bombed by the Germans. And because of Belle Skinner and her efforts to restore the village, it exists to this day. And I wondered, you know, growing up, I heard about her, and I just, you know, thought, well, what would inspire this woman who was then in her 50s, leading a very comfortable life, to become so involved in rebuilding a devastated village in the north of France? And as I did some research into her story, I discovered that when she was 8 years old, the village into which she'd been born, Skinnerville, Massachusetts, was destroyed in a flood and never rebuilt. And I began to research this flood as a way to understand Belle Skinner's story, and yet the more I researched the flood, I realized that was a story that I had to tell, and Bell Skinner's father, William Skinner, was my great-great-grandfather, and he was a central figure in this disaster, and he was the only man who was able to turn the disaster into a success story. And that success, you know, lasted until the family sold the company in 1961. So, you know, I knew how his story ended because I had grown up familiar with hearing about the company. I knew that he built this company that had become so successful. It was one of the largest silk mills in the world. And hearing about that success made me appreciate what he was able to do after the flood, because when the Mill River flood occurred on May 16, 1874, William Skinner lost absolutely everything in 15 minutes. And he was 49 years old, and he had to figure out what was he going to do, how is he going to come back, how could he rebuild his company, if he could rebuild it, where does he go from there?
It is absolutely spellbinding story that you tell in this book, American Phoenix. I hardly know where to start. Love to start with the disaster itself, but I think I'm going to hold off for a minute because I want you to tell us more about your great-great-grandfather, William Skinner. He became probably one of the wealthiest individuals in the United States at the time that he was alive. Very wealthy, had built a magnificent house, first in Skinnerville and then later in Holyoke, Massachusetts, a house that still stands. And yet, he was born into, one might say, incredibly humble origins.
That would be an understatement.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, Skinner was born November 14th. He was born yesterday, was his birthday. We're recording this on the 15th of November. He was born on November 14th, 1824 in East London. And he was born into a community of silk workers, and they had been making silk for generations. But they were so poor and malnourished that they were called a stunted, puny race. The poverty in this section of East London called Spitalfields, which today is a very posh neighborhood, but are becoming more posh, I should say, in the 1820s, it was abject poverty. The life expectancy in some parts of it was 16. And one of the advocates for the welfare of the silk workers said that it is not that a few starve, but that so many are on the verge of starvation. It is not that a few suffer, but that so few escape. And Skinner did escape. He came over to America at the age of 20, and that was, I can only imagine, a very powerful decision. And it turned out, of course, to be an extremely significant one. But when he left, he was the oldest of seven children. And he was admittedly one of the, if not the largest breadwinner in his family. He was a silk dyer, and he'd been working since the age of four. So by the age of 20, he was a master silk dyer. He was making money that was helping to support his family. If he left, not only left Spitalfields, but left the country, there was a good chance he would never see or talk to his family again. Immigration in the 19th century was a form of death. It was a virtual exile. And so he was potentially contributing to profound instability and leaving his younger brothers to carry on as the heads of the family and try to support their yet younger siblings and their mother. His father had died several years before. Skinner's father had died several years before. And yet, if Skinner left and if he made it, he potentially was leading a path for some of his siblings to follow. So that was the flip side of the coin. And Skinner came to this country. He had absolutely nothing of any material value whatsoever. But he did have one thing of extreme value that no American had at the time, and that was a knowledge of how to dye silk.
Yeah, so tell us, give us a little bit about the history of silk. What was going on here? I mean, first of all, where was America in terms of the silk manufacturing business? How come there were no dyers here? And how come there were dyers in Spitalfields?
Well, dyeing is a very ancient art. And it had the art of manufacturing silk, you know, had originated in China about 2600 BC, and gradually spread from China, you know, through Europe and then over to England, and it had yet to make its way to America. And the young democracy had no silk industry. People over in America, we didn't know how to make it. We didn't know how to manufacture it, didn't know what the machinery looked like, had no concept of how to dye silk, how to make a black that would last, that wouldn't rub off on your skin or flake at the slightest touch. And, you know, these are domestic and industrial arts that had been passed down through the centuries in Europe and in the Far East. And so Skinner, having grown up in this community of silk workers in England, he was steeped in the traditions of how to make and manufacture silk. And when he arrived in this country, he brought what Americans didn't have. He brought some of what Americans didn't have. And so that gave him an opportunity right off the bat. And he established first a successful dyeing business for himself. And there were a few mills in the area. There are most of them were localized in New England, and several were in the Northampton, Florence area. And so what he did was he started dyeing silks for these very fledgling silk mills that were trying to figure out how to make a silk product that could rival silks coming in from Europe and England. And there was a lot of money to be made in silk. So, you know, it's the most prestigious fabric. It was a symbol of prosperity. This was an age when fabric was fashion. And so anyone of any worth who wanted to display their wealth, they wanted to have silk as a part of their dress, as a, you know, as a part of the decor in their house. And so Americans were figuring out, how do we get in on the silk business? Well, we're going to have to learn a lot of it from the Europeans, from the English. And so, you know, some of these immigrants like Skinner were pioneers and came over to this country with these skills. And Skinner became one of the founding members of the American silk industry. He helped build that silk industry in this country. And by, you know, I'll sort of fast forward a little bit, Skinner said, used to say, there is not an Irish servant girl who comes over to this country, America, whose ambition is not to wear a silk dress. And as the Industrial Revolution grew, the middle class grew, and everyone wanted to wear silk. And by the 20th century, American silk was big business. So in the 1840s, when Skinner arrived, he arrived in 1845, there was no silk industry of any significance in this country. But within, 55 years, by the turn of the 20th century, American silk was of such huge significance to the economy that there was a silk train that would pick up the raw silk that was imported from the Orient, from the Far East, would arrive on the West Coast. That silk train would take that silk and whisk it across the country to the northeastern mills. And that train had right-of-way over every other train on the track. And the cargo was so valuable that the only passengers allowed on the train were armed guards. And America, by the turn of the 20th century, was the largest consumer of silk goods in the world, and we were manufacturing more than 75% of our own silk. So Skinner was a pioneer when he came to this country, and he was a pioneer in one of the most successful textile businesses, you know, of the 19th century.
And it is an amazing story. You know, and it was not an easy thing to make silk. I'm reading this book, American Phoenix. I thought, my God, it's a miracle that this that silk even exists.
Yes.
I mean, it's probably too much detail to go into, but just tell us, why is it so hard to actually make silk?
Well, it's, you know, funny that you should ask that question, because I literally just got a friend of mine is reading the book right now, and she emailed me last night, and she said, what does she say? She says, where is it? I'm trying to look it up right now, and, you know, multitask in this modern age, which is certainly something they didn't do back then. She said, you know, did you know how intricate silk making was before you started researching? And my answer was, not a clue. I had no idea what making silk involved. And, you know, when you think that a little tiny silk cocoon is wound with one continuous strand of silk that's half a mile long, that in itself is extraordinary. And then silk is a fiber of silk is triangular in shape. And that's actually what allows it to refract light like no other natural fiber. And it is very difficult to describe how silk is made. In a nutshell, you know, this tiny, barely perceptible silk strand around a silk cocoon is unwound and then combined with other strands from other cocoons. And that yet is not a strand of silk thread. It's still too fine to be woven. And yet, at that point, it has some density and is therefore able to be reeled into a silk thread. So, you know, it's sort of like a pyramid. You start with one cocoon, you combine that strand with other strands of cocoons from other cocoons, and then you combine that with other combinations of other strands from other cocoons, and you eventually come up with a silk thread. And then from that, you can either send the thread to the dye house to be dyed and then woven, or you can weave it first and then dye it. The better way to do it is to dye it first and then weave it, but the cheaper, quicker way is to weave it and then dye it. There are all different ways in which to manufacture silk thread and in which to manufacture then silk cloth. They're just the different kinds of weaves are extraordinary, and it's too much for this conversation.
No, that's pretty good. I mean, it's like weaving a little gossamer nothing into some of the strongest fabric there is. I mean, it's a miracle in itself.
Well, yes, and silk is the strongest natural fiber. So it's this teeny little, as you said, gossamer thing, and yet it is almost identical in strength as a piece of iron wire of similar diameter.
Just remarkable.
Yeah.
So why did it come, why was, you know, a fairly significant portion of the early silk manufacturing industry located in the Northampton area on the Mill River in Massachusetts? The Mill River is a tributary to the Great Connecticut River.
Yes. You know, that is a good question. Sometimes some locations are simply luckier than others. A man named Samuel Whitmarsh came to Northampton, and he had this idea of creating a factory that would make silk from the moth to the cloth. And what Americans originally started doing, which in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, is they were trying to make the raw silk first, and then manufacture our own raw silk into silk fabric, silk cloth. That makes sense, but again, making raw silk, which is, you know, the idea, well, making raw silk, raising the silk cocoons, raising the silk moth, again, is another extremely difficult process, and Americans were unable to figure out how to do it successfully. But Whitmarsh had established a silk growing farm in Northampton, and that generated considerable interest. Again, because here was this opportunity for Americans to get in on the silk business. If we could figure out how to do it, Americans could make a lot of money. And so Whitmarsh's establishment drew an intense amount of attention. And that inspired other people within the area to think about making silk. And because there were so few individuals at this time engaged in this kind of work, it benefited them to be near each other so that they could learn from each other's mistakes. And they could band together and try to figure out how to overcome the excellence of the European products. And so while in a sense they were each other's competitors, at this point in time, they were also each other's best friends in this industry. And I think that's one of the reasons why Northampton became so famous in the early days for silk manufacturing, was because Whitmarsh started there, and then others came and established mills nearby so that they could each, you know, help each other.
Hmm. And we're talking with Sarah S. Kilborn. That S stands for Skinner. Sarah Kilborn is the great-great-granddaughter of the subject of her remarkable book. It's called American Phoenix, The Remarkable Story of William Skinner, A Man Who Turned Disaster into Destiny. And we're getting close to the disaster part here because we come to the Mill River. Now, tell the Mill River, I looked it up on the internet, and Wikipedia says that it's notable for dropping in elevation along its west branch more than 700 feet over 15 miles, which I guess is what gave it some of its power.
Yes.
So tell us about the dam that William Skinner and some of these other silk manufacturers had built for them.
Well, the Mill River is a tributary of the Connecticut, and it was the water source for the power source for a thriving industrial valley, the Mill River Valley in western Massachusetts. And yet, on its own, the Mill River, like every other river in New England, was unreliable because depending on the season, depending on how much rain there was, depending on the snow melt, it could either be a raging source or it could be bone dry. And so in order to regulate the water on the river, industrialists below banded together and formed corporations to build reservoirs at the head of the river to provide more power during the dry seasons. And William Skinner was one of the owners of the Williamsburg Reservoir that was built on the east branch of the reservoir, of the river, in 1865. And there was another reservoir on the west branch of the river that had been built many years earlier, but it wasn't sufficient to provide enough power for the mills following the Civil War, when many of these mills were experiencing an extreme boom in their business because the war effort really was an impetus for generating more industry and more business for textile manufacturers. And so they built a second reservoir on the east branch of the Mill River, and it was built in 1865, and it leaked almost from the start and went through several rounds of repairs. It was an earthen dam, and it was almost the length of two football fields, by 1874, 9 years after it had been built, most people below it felt secure about it. It had lasted for 9 years. It had leaked in the beginning. It leaked periodically. But, you know, the manufacturers who owned it lived below it just like everybody else. Their businesses were just as at risk in the event that the dam would give way as everybody else's homes and farms. And, you know, it had been repaired, and the county commissioners had signed off on it. And so everybody assumed and sort of crossed their fingers and hoped for the best and thought that it would last forever. The previous dam that had been built that impounded the water in the reservoir on the western branch, you know, had survived for many, many years and was still doing fine. So there was no reason to believe that anything would go wrong with the reservoir on the east branch of the river.
But something did to go terribly wrong, as you said before, May 16th, 1874. Describe the scene.
On the morning of May 16th, 1874, George Cheney, the gatekeeper of the dam, was sitting down to breakfast with his family, and his father looked out the window and saw a chunk of the dam slough off and pass away downstream. And he immediately shouted to his son to, you know, go check on the dam, look at the dam. And George ran out. He noticed that water was already beginning to percolate through the exposed earth that was left after that chunk of the dam gave way. It had left a huge crater in the dam. And he opened up the sluice pipe to try to relieve pressure on the dam, and then immediately jumped onto his horse and raced 3 miles down the valley to the nearest town, Williamsburg, to alert his boss, the general manager of the dam, Onslow Spellman, that he thought the dam was giving way. And the George Cheney's horse had never been ridden before. It was a farm horse, and Cheney was so poor he didn't own a saddle. So he jumped onto the horse bareback and raced this terrified horse 3 miles to Onslow Spellman's house. And he got to Spellman's house, banged on the door. His horse is frothing in the yard. It's raining out. And Spellman doesn't believe Cheney and says, well, if you really believe that the dam is giving way, then you go yourself warn the people below. And Cheney was exasperated. He couldn't ride his horse any further. The horse was spent. And so he went over to the livery keeper and tried to get a horse from the livery keeper. And the livery keeper wasn't going to lend out one of his fabulous, you know, good horses to this small-minded farmer who looked terrified. But the alarm was so preposterous it was not to be believed. And a milkman, a dairy farmer, rode into town about that time and, you know, was so struck by the appearance of the gatekeeper that, unlike the other men who sort of just took Cheney as a scared, small-minded man, the dairy farmer took Cheney as a man who had seen something horrific happened, and he believed him. And the dairy farmer named Collins Graves said, I'll go warn the people below. You warn the folks here in Williamsburg. I'll go warn the people below. And they all thought that they had plenty of time to do all this warning. They assumed that, well, the reservoir was filled with 600 million gallons of water. It covered 111 acres. It was going to take a long time for that water to drain down the countryside. And they thought it would be passing or entering Williamsburg at about noon. And this is before 8 o'clock in the morning. They had no idea that the reservoir was less than 10 minutes away. And so Collins Graves goes down and he rides his dairy cart. He still has milk cans in, you know, in his buggy.
And they're falling out. He's just clattering down the road.
Yeah, he's clattering down the road. The milk cans are falling out. And he believed that he had to, this is a drive by the mills, as close as possible. And his intent was to warn the people in the mills because they've been at work for, you know, at least an hour by now, and they were going to have the hardest time hearing any warning because of all the machinery that was, you know, going on around them. And so Graves rides his buggy downstream, and he rides as close as he can to the mills, and he shouts, the Williamsburg Reservoir is giving way, the reservoir is giving way. And and then begin shouting to the hills, to the hills, to the hills. And further down the valley, another messenger also in a buggy, an express wagon, hears Collins Graves, and he takes a charge further down the valley. I'm going to backtrack just a minute. When Collins Graves rides through Williamsburg, the first village, he rides through the tip of it, warns the inhabitants and the factory workers at the Henry James Woolen Mill. Then he went down to Skinnerville, and he warned the villagers in Skinnerville. He warned William Skinner, and he warned the factory workers at the silk mill. He was about 5 minutes ahead of the water at that time. And when he got to Haydenville, the next village, he was barely 2 minutes ahead of the water, and the water caught up to him in Haydenville. And this other man, Myron Day, at the bottom of Haydenville, looked up, saw the water coming into the village, and he's the one who took the alarm and raced further downstream with it to warn everybody that, oh my God, the reservoir is on its way, it's here. But a lot of people aren't going to necessarily believe you if you start shouting, the Williamsburg Reservoir has given way, you know, run to the hills. It's a kind of a mouthful of words, and it just, you're kind of left thinking, what, you know? So these messengers at one point just started shouting, fire, 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 you know, to get people to pay attention and to leave the mills and to run as fast as they could to the hillside to escape the water.
Wow. Now, there's something in the background. Is that stopping now?
No, that is, unfortunately, my boiler. I can move rooms.
Can you?
Yes.
But will that take you away from the base of this phone then?
No, I can carry the phone with me.
Okay, great. All right.
Yes, I live above what sounds like its own steam engine, you know? you know, fire up the hold is kind of how I feel like when my boiler goes on.
Let me know when you're there.
I'm here. I'm ready. Okay. Is this better for you?
Oh, much better.
Oh, great.
So now tell us what this wall of water was like. I mean, this was no, like, you know, nice little flow coming down. This was like
Hardly.
A tsunami.
Yes. It was an extraordinary inland tidal wave. It was 20 to 40 feet high. At points, it was 300 feet wide. And it was a plow coming down the mountainside. So it was just churning up the entire country below it. And it was just filled with absolutely everything. It was filled with trees and mud and rocks and boulders, massive boulders that had been in place for centuries were uprooted by this wave. It was picking up mills, you know, farm animals, tools, people, children, everything in its path it picked up and took. And in regard to those who died in the flood, you either lived or you died. If you got caught in the waters, you died. If you escaped to the hillside, you lived. There were few people that were simply hurt. And the villagers in Skinnerville, when they got the warning that the reservoir was on its way, and they were running to the hillside, to the railroad embankment for safety, one of the villagers looked upstream and looked up to the north where the town of Williamsburg, the village of Williamsburg was, and said, my God, they're all burning out up there, because the sky to the north appeared black. It appeared as though the entire village of Williamsburg was on fire. But in fact, that was the black spray of the reservoir water just filling up the sky. And the water was black. It did not look like water at all, because it was filled with all of this matter. It was just a wall of blackness, and those who were ahead of it were filled and shrouded in spray long before the water actually hit them or hit, you know, where they were. And often it was this condensation that overcame them that was another warning, if you will, to run, 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 run as fast as you can. Run up the hillside. You have seconds to escape.
And so now describe to us what Skinnerville was like in, you know, before this huge wall of water hit and what that wall of water then did. But first tell us what was there before the disaster.
Right. Skinnerville was a beautiful, lovely little village. And it was a thriving industrial village. Skinner had established a mill there, his silk mill there, in the 1850s. And, you know, by 1874, there was a thriving silk mill community that had grown up around his mill. He had one of the largest silk mills in the state. And when he moved to this area, there were a few farmhouses here and there, but there was no village. And so his industry really created a community of people that were living and working together, farming, working together. Farming meaning the farmers in the area were farming, and their children were working in the mill, helping to contribute to their family's income. And then other families moved in specifically to work in the mill. Some of the residents of the village opened up their houses, and they became boarding houses. And Skinner had two boarding houses of his own at the time of the flood. And it was a village that was filled with about 200 people. There was a schoolhouse. There was a general store. The village was such a significant part of the town of Williamsburg, the depot for the town of Williamsburg was actually in Skinnerville. It wasn't in Williamsburg proper. It was actually in Skinnerville. And so, you know, you had this community of people. There were, you know, women who were pregnant, expecting to give their child, you know, in a couple of months. One woman had just given birth to a child 2 days before the flood. Another man had just moved to town a few months earlier to start a dairy farm. You know, children were growing up and marrying and, you know, working in the mills and contributing to a sense of fullness within this area.
And these were good jobs. These weren't the kind of dark, satanic mills of Charles Dickens fame.
Correct. And that was one of the things that does set, at this time, small factory villages like Skinner's apart from the industrial centers of England. And Dickens commented on that when he came to the States, and so did Anthony Trollope. You know, they were amazed that American women did not suffer the way that they suffered in the English mills. And now, of course, there were large industrial centers that over time were not great places to work. But in the middle of the 19th century, there were these villages that were very supportive to young, independent, ambitious women. And, you know, women would come to work in these mills. It was an opportunity to make some money. It was an opportunity to have some independence. And it was considered respectable work. And, you know, there were curfews in these villages. And there was a sense of propriety. There was a sense of if you were admitted into the boarding house, you had to follow a strict set of rules to maintain the propriety of the boarding house, to maintain the propriety of the mill, to maintain this sense of, you know, ethics and morality of this mill village. And so there was a very conscious effort to, you know, build a community that would welcome young, independent women and that would support them and not in any way compromise their character or their integrity. And so this was valuable work for a young woman at that time. And, in fact, one of the strongest female voice in my book is actually that of a mill worker. Her name was Ellen Littlefield, and she came to Skinnerville in the 1860s, and she followed one of her sisters. She followed two of her sisters that had come to work for Skinner, and they were from upstate New York. And the first to arrive was a young woman named Levice. She was about 20 years old, and she had heard from cousins north of Skinnerville that Skinner was looking for factory, looking for some new girls to work in his factory. And she applied for the job, and she became an expert spooler. And what that meant was that she wound the raw silk onto the actual spools. Sorry, she wound the finished silk thread onto the actual spools that would go to market. And it was a job that required incredible skill, and she was fantastic at it. And when Ellen arrived at the mill, Ellen worked in the packing department. So she would pack the spools that, say, her sister would make, and she would then be the one to be handing these packaged boxes of silk to the shippers to be shipped to the store, to Skinner's store, and to Skinner's, you know, clients throughout the region. And you know, at the time of the flood, you had, you know, sisters like the Littlefield sisters who had, Ellen was the last remaining. She was the only remaining Littlefield sister at the time of the flood. But you had many sisters still working for Skinner. You had the Kendall sisters from Vermont. The whole, you know, many members of the Bartlett family worked for Skinner. There was a sense of familiar, there's a sense of family to the community of workers that worked in his mill because so many siblings worked together in the mill. And so at the time of the flood, you did have this sense of family and the sense of respectable work. This was a village that was considered to be integral to the future of the town of Williamsburg. People thought, you know, what could Skinnerville become one day? It's growing so rapidly. It might one day bridge the village of Williamsburg with the village of Haydenville below it and make, you know, one huge industrial center as opposed to these three separate industrial villages. And so at the time of the flood, there was a sense of future. There was a sense of excitement for the future. And Skinner himself had just come home from one of the most successful and business trips that he'd had. He had been in New York City just a few days before, celebrating the second anniversary of the Silk Association of America. The silk manufacturing had, you know, become such an entity, had become such a business, I should say, that now the silk manufacturers had an organization devoted to them to promote them throughout, you know, with Congress and whatnot for better tariffs and this sorts of thing. Mm-hmm. And they were celebrating the second anniversary of their association. Skinner was hailed as a pioneer in the field. He had given one of the speeches at the event, and his speech was one of the speeches that was quoted in the papers the next day as symbolic of the future of the silk industry in this country and of what men could achieve and what they could still achieve. And, you know, he comes home on May 15th, takes the train home from the city. May 15th is his 18th wedding anniversary with his second wife. And so he goes to bed on the night of May 15th, really on top of the world. He is at the center of this factory village. He has a silk mill in America. His name is on the American map, Skinnerville. This poor kid from England has made it in America to a degree that he never could have imagined. He's just celebrated his 18th wedding anniversary, been hailed as a pioneer in his field. He's made it. And then the following morning, he loses everything.
So tell us what, I mean, what was swept away in that flood. And now his house was left standing, which I think is fascinating.
Yes.
And thank goodness it was, because it became a kind of, emergency relief center. But what did he lose?
So to give you a sense of the power of the water, and this will come into play into explaining why so much was lost. That water went through the upper villages in the valley of Williamsburg, Skinnerville, and Haydenville in Leeds in 15 minutes each, whereas in Northampton it took about an hour and a half for that water to flow through Northampton and empty into the Connecticut River, because the lower portion of the valley levels out into an alluvial plain. But as you mentioned earlier, you know, the upper portion of the valley is much steeper, and that's why a lot of industry was up there to take advantage of the grade of the river. But of course, at a moment like this, that works against you. And so the water went through Skinnerville in 15 minutes and obliterated it. And Skinnerville suffered the worst destruction of any village in the valley. They did say it had been obliterated from the face of the earth. It had been annihilated. And the only, just about the only building that was left standing was Skinner's house. And he lived in a mansion. It was the biggest house in the village. It was one of the biggest houses in town. And they said that it survived the waters probably for two reasons. One was that it had five chimneys that anchored it to the ground. And the other was that it was made of brick. It was made of board and not bricks. So whereas Skinner's mill was entirely a brick, and that just was shattered to smithereens when the water hit it, Skinner's house, being so huge, being made of, being clapboarded, being made of wood, acted like its own dam in the midst of the surge. So the water rushed up against it and then surged around the sides, and miraculously didn't carry it away. The house could be seen swaying in the water from the railroad embankment. And the water filled the village up to such an extent that Skinner would later say, as he stood on the embankment watching this happen, that it felt as though he was standing on the deck of a ship in the middle of a storm. And, you know, once the water had passed, there was nothing left of the village. The houses that were there still were, you know, they were no longer on their foundations. They had been tipped over. They had been swept across the meadows. You know, there was all the grass, all the farmland was completely carried off. Huge craters remained. You know, animals, all the farm animals were completely gone, except for actually Skinner's horses. His barn, too, miraculously survived, and there is some question as to how that happened, but it was completely filled, flooded with water, and his horses were flooded up to their necks and had to be dug out and rescued. And, you know, there was just, it was a wasteland. It was an apocalyptic expanse of just sand and stones. And everything in Skinnerville was swept off and, you know, landed throughout the rest of the valley miles away. You know, silk from Skinner's mill was found 4 miles away in the Florence Meadows. And the Florence Meadows were where most of the upper villages landed. The debris in the meadows was as high as a man is tall. And, you know, if you wanted to find anything that you'd lost, you walked those miles downstream to the Florence Meadows and started searching through, you know, the acreage of debris that was down there. Because if you lost something, that was going to be your best chance of finding it, if you could find it. And that's where they also found most of the dead bodies, was also down there.
What a story. We're talking with Sarah Skinner Kilborn about her book, American Phoenix. It's the remarkable story of her great-great-grandfather, William Skinner, a man who turned disaster into destiny. Now, you mentioned before, you know, that there was a very high sense of propriety and morality, of integrity, in fact. And Skinner himself was known as a man of his word. Say, what role did that play? I mean, after everything was gone, he'd lost everything. In fact, he was quite shocked. He was really a man in shock. He didn't think... I could almost hear the words going through his mind. I was born in poverty, and now I've lost everything. I'm back in poverty. But that's not what happened. What was the immediate reaction to people to this terrible disaster that befell this man, and what did his character have to do with that?
Yes, well, Skinner was in complete shock once the disaster happened. You know, he said, you know, a neighbor overheard him muttering, "I worked for what I had, and now it is all gone." There wasn't a brick left of his silk mill. I mean, it was the equivalent. The thing, I mean, I was in New York City at 9-11. I lived in Manhattan during 9-11. And I remember that when those Twin Towers were gone, it was the hardest thing for me to get my head around, the fact that they were gone. And that was the only thing that I could tap into understand what Skinner might have experienced after the flood. Because his huge silk mill, everything that he'd had, was gone. There was nothing left of it. And so... you know, and he was in tremendous debt from that moment on, because he had the largest supply of raw silk on hand that he'd ever had, that was purchased entirely on credit, and he was immediately in the hole. In those 15 minutes, he lost the equivalent today of $35 million, much of that being debt that he was going to have to pay back somehow. So he was in shock. He had no idea what to do, and unlike the other manufacturers in the valley, he did not immediately say what he thought he could or could not do. He said, "I need time. I need time to think. I don't know what I'm going to do." And, you know, other manufacturers said, "Oh, we're rebuilding right away." And that gave their villagers hope, but Skinner stepped back and said, "I don't know. I can't promise you anything right now." And one of the things that did work to his advantage, as you just mentioned, was his reputation. Skinner had an extraordinary reputation for being an honest, reputable businessman. And he had been successful, so successful in business, because of his dealings with people. And so, you know, once the disaster happened and he was wiped out, he began to receive offers from many, many localities to remove from Skinnerville, from the Mill River Valley, move elsewhere, rebuild elsewhere. And it was, you know, this reputation that he had that inspired confidence in people that he would be able to come back if he just had the means to do so. And so that was definitely something that came into play that worked towards, you know, to his favor. And, you know, he did have to be reminded of that, though, in those early days, because he was so taken aback. He couldn't believe what had happened, and he considered himself ruined. And you know, when a local minister said, you know, tried to remind him, you know, that you still have your name, you still have your name. And so while that was sort of cold comfort at the moment, because, you know, he was, in a sense, he was back at the beginning with just his name. He was going to have to build on his name, you know, and the knowledge in his head once more. But this time around, that was valuable currency. Well, I mean, his knowledge of silk in the beginning was valuable currency, and then the name that he built based on that knowledge became even more valuable currency at the time of the flood.
Yeah, amazing. Now, it turned out that he got an offer that he decided to take up to reestablish not too far away. It's just some 15 miles away down on the Connecticut River this time. The most amazing, remarkable city. I think the first industrial city in America, I've heard it called. Still a city that still runs 60% of its electrical power is still supplied by the dam that it built there, and that is Holyoke, Massachusetts, on the Connecticut River. So tell us a little bit about this offer and, you know, what went on from there.
Well, Holyoke actually wasn't the first industrially planned city in America.
Lowell
was.
That's right.
But it was one of the first, you could say. And, you know, after the flood, the valley's loss was going to be somebody else's potential gain. And so Skinner began to receive offers from all over, and other manufacturers began to receive offers from all over. And, you know, offers were coming in from as far away as Omaha, Nebraska. And the best offers were coming in from Holyoke. And Holyoke, as you mentioned, was this extraordinarily planned city specifically for industry. And it was considered to have a greater potential for success than Lowell, Massachusetts. You know, at that one area, the Connecticut River falls about 60 feet and is theoretically able to generate about 30,000 horsepower, which is just a phenomenal amount of power that could theoretically power hundreds of mills. And
I have to interrupt here. I have to say I have visited the waterworks of that dam. It is just incredible, just the force of nature harnessed to human need. It is overpowering. It's a magnificent sight. Have you ever been there?
I have, yes. Not in a while. I'd like to go back, but it is awesome. And that power is harnessed. The Connecticut River, this mighty, humongous river, you know, its power was harnessed and then funneled into a three-tiered canal system. And so the water is not just flowing through one canal or being dissipated through a network of canals. It is being sent into a three-tiered system where Holyoke's canals are staggered down a slope, and the water from the Connecticut River is able to be used over three times. And it, for a manufacturer like Skinner, just in terms of water power, Holyoke had just incredible appeal. Skinner's mill was primarily dependent on water power. Steam was too expensive for him. He did own a steam engine to supplement his mill in during the dry seasons, but he couldn't run his operation entirely on steam. And he also, since he also dyed silk as well as manufactured silk, he needed copious amounts of water for the dyeing process. So he had to be located near water. And the Williamsburg Reservoir, once it gave way, was never going to be rebuilt. And Skinner simply could not figure out how he was going to be able to rebuild in Skinnerville and be able to support an operation going forward, given that he was in such debt, he needed to climb out of the debt, and he couldn't take on more financial responsibilities. So he needed to figure out how to continue manufacturing the way that he'd been continuing to manufacture, meaning using water power, which is basically free, and go from there. And Holyoke came along and said, look, we will build you a mill, and you don't have to put a penny down for it. This is May of 1874. We'll have a mill built for you by the fall. And in January, you can only need to start paying us interest payments on that mill. And in 5 years, you can purchase the mill at its original cost. You can purchase the lot that's being built on at its original cost. The lot was worth, I believe, $6,000. And, you know, they also said, we will give you rent-free property along the canals for 5 years. And we will give you an acre of land for free upon which to build a new house. So Skinner was basically offered by Holyoke the golden ticket. He did not have to put any money down for a new mill. He would only have to start making interest payments on that mill in January. He didn't have to worry about paying rent along the canals, and he was going to get most of his water power for free.
And why? Why did Holyoke give him this incredibly generous offer? What was in it for them? And this was more than just the government, the city fathers. I mean, these were manufacturers like him. Is that right?
Well, it was the contracting company. The Newton brothers built the mill, and they were in concert with the Holyoke Water Power Company, which regulated the canals and the water power. And the water power company was very powerful because they were building up the industry of the city. And the contractor, the Newton brothers, were also very powerful because they were building most of the mills in the city at that time. It was a win-win situation for everyone because even if Skinner's business did not survive, the Newtons had a mill that they were going to be able to rent to somebody else. And so what this gave them, though, is the incentive to build a mill and to potentially lure a new business to town that could reap great profits for the city. You know, Skinner's Mill was one of the largest silk mills in the state, and it was these smaller manufacturers in Holyoke that were beginning to fill in the smaller lots along the canals. They had some huge mills, but they also wanted to fill in the smaller lots with these smaller mills. And so Skinner's was a smaller mill in comparison to the larger cotton mills and would fit just beautifully into the growing landscape of the city. And but, you know, Skinner's silk mill was not the biggest fish to catch in the Mill River Valley. The largest fish to catch there was the brassworks in Haydenville, which was one of the largest in the country. And the water power company really wanted the Haydenville brassworks to move and to be and to rebuild in Holyoke. And they went after Joel Hayden Jr., who was the president of the company, quite hard, and apparently they made him better offers than they made Skinner. But Hayden turned them down, and Skinner didn't. And that was the turning point in both of those men's careers, because Joel Hayden Jr. went into bankruptcy, unable to rebuild the mill in Haydenville successfully, And Skinner went to Holyoke and was able to build on this new foundation, was able to get the ground back underneath him as he rebuilt, since he didn't have to worry about, you know, all of the expenses going into starting up a manufactory. He was able to have somebody else carry the weight of those expenses, and he just had to figure out how to, you know, continue on with his business and build it. And so he was able to get out of debt with a new structure that was also the structure of his dreams. The contractors said, you know, essentially, so what kind of mill do you want? And Skinner drew out the mill that he wanted. That, you know, there was land to expand in Holyoke. I mean, the sky's the limit, you know, in terms of what he could ever possibly have. As opposed to in Skinnerville, you know, there was a limit to how big the mill could grow because there was only so much power that he was going to be able to draw off of the Mill River. So, you know, but back to the decision-making process. So Skinner chose to go to Holyoke, and none of the other manufacturers did. And they all suffered as a result of that.
And as a result, he became, you write in this book, American Phoenix, he became one of the largest silk manufacturers in the world.
Yes.
And had a huge impact on advertising and fashion. We only have a little bit of time left, but just sketch out for us what the impact, I mean, silk is, you know, it was sold in 61. I mean, silk is no longer an industry in the valley. In fact, there's not a whole lot of industry left in Holyoke, unfortunately. I mean, there still is some, but most of the old mills are being converted into office buildings and condominiums. So, but what was the impact that he had on fashion, on advertising, with his silk manufacturing business?
Skinner had extraordinary impact. His company did. So, you know, he got his start. He got a second chance in Holyoke, and he took it and he ran with it. It wasn't easy. It was a difficult road the first number of years. He did have to climb out of a tremendous amount of debt. But what he did when he moved to Holyoke was he expanded into manufacturing braids, silk braids, which were then very popular in covering up loose seams in men's clothing. And he began weaving braids. And at this point, weaving silk was still in its infancy in America. But Skinner, again, was one of the pioneers that branched out into weaving silk and, you know, branched out into a new department of the silk industry. And so he began to weave silk in Holyoke, and he started with braids and ribbons, and then went into silk linings, and eventually began, his company manufactured every single possible thing that could be made with silk. Blankets, parachutes, you know, bathing suits, you name it, the company made it. And the company was extremely innovative, just like Skinner was. And, you know, his sons inherited the company when he died in 1902. They had been working for him all of their lives, and they took it over, Joe and Will, and they were a brilliant team. Joe was the scientist, and he ran the mills, and he ran the lab at the mills, inventing new fabrics. And Will ran the marketing end of the business from the headquarters in New York City. And so with the two of them at the helm, they steered the company into the 20th century, successfully through the turbulent 1920s, when much of the silk industry suffered at the, you know, from the introduction of artificial silk and rayon, and they steered the company also through the Depression, and you know, into the 1940s, where the company experienced a second, a sort of a resurgence in popularity with their silk products being used in the war effort, and also returning soldiers after the war, getting married, you know, as we know, and creating the ultimate baby boom. All those, so many of those brides were married in Skinner's satin, and that was the popularity of Skinner's bridal satin in the 1940s and 1950s catapulted the company to even greater success. And industry experts said that that is what made Skinner a household word in the United States, like Kleenex. You know, if you were going to buy silk and satin, you wanted Skinner's. And they were one of the first textile companies to branch out into consumer advertising, beginning with an ad in Ladies Home Journal, I believe it was, in the early 1900s. And every decade thereafter, up until the 1960s, ads for Skinner's could be found in every single major American magazine, Town and Country, Vogue, The New Yorker. In the 1920s, Will, in charge of marketing, wooed Hollywood. And, you know, he could see that with this burgeoning cinema, the costume designers were using Skinner's fabrics to dress their stars because of the wearing quality of the Skinner silk and its luxury, its extraordinary draping facilities. It didn't tear, it didn't split. A costume designer could rely on it. He could rely on it to make his star look gorgeous. And so Will teamed up with the head costume designer of MGM, a man named Adrian, very famous, and they did a campaign for Skinner's. And in these campaigns were featured, you know, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, and, you know, major stars of the time wearing these gowns of Skinner silks and satins. And the company was so successful in the 20th century that Reader's Digest, which had the largest readership in America in the middle of the century, included William Skinner in a list of one of the most influential Englishmen to land on American soil. Because Skinner had come over with nothing except for this one skill, how to dye silk, that he parlayed into opportunity after opportunity, and he'd helped grow the American silk industry in this company. He had come back from disaster, and he had built one of the largest silk mills in the world. And then the company lasted, you know, well into the 20th century, draping, dressing, you know, millions of Americans, generations of Americans. And the company, when, you know, before the advent of designers, companies like Skinner's actually steered fashion. They were very much on the front lines of what made fashion. And so, one of the ads says, you know, when Paris says crepe, when Paris says crepe satin, America answers Skinner's or something like that. The sense that Skinner's was the arbiter of fashion that was coming from abroad. You know, if you wanted something that people were wearing in Paris, well, you could get it in America, you could get it from Skinner's. And so, you know, Skinner's had a tremendous impact on fashion, generating it, generating the trends, supporting the trends, steering the trends. That ultimately, of course, came to an end because fashion changed so extraordinarily and, you know, artificial silks changed the whole game, you know, forever. And but for its lifetime, the company lasted for 113 years, one of the longest family-run companies in the silk industry and in the textile industry, too. And it had a pretty good run, I think you'd say.
Well, it is a fascinating story. The book is an absolute page-turner. I so hugely enjoyed reading it. It's American Phoenix, the remarkable story of William Skinner, the man who turned disaster into destiny. We've been talking with Skinner's great-great-great-granddaughter, Sarah Skinner Kilborn. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Francesca.